Good day, ladies and gentlemen. It gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Enis Baris, who is a medical doctor with graduate degrees in public health and epidemiology and a wide range of experience in development and research over 30 countries. Prior to joining the World Bank, Dr. Baris worked in academia for the World Health Organization Regional Office in Europe, and more recently at the International Development Research Center of Canada, as Chief Scientist and Senior Scientific Advisor. Dr. Baris initiated and managed numerous single and multi-country research and development projects on macroeconomic adjustment policies, health sector reform, and on public health challenges such as tuberculosis, malaria, HIV, AIDS. While with IDRC, he also was Executive Director of the Research for International Tobacco Control, a multi-donor funded secretariat to promote public policies for tobacco control. He also served on the board of the Council of Health Research for Development and the Alliance for Health System and Policy Research. Since joining the bank in 1999, Dr. Baris, as a senior public health specialist, has been engaged in policy dialogue, preparation of projects on health and human development in the regions of the East Asia and Pacific and Europe and Central Asia. His technical work at the bank also includes development research on HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, indoor air pollution and lung health, as well as broader health system development issues. He is a board member and chair of the Coordinating Committee of Scientific Activities of the International Union Against Tuberculosis and Lung Diseases. He also sits on the editorial board of and frequently acts as peer reviewer for several international peer-reviewed journals. He's going to speak to us on the avian influenza, how ready are the health systems to detect and manage the purported pandemic. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome with me, Dr. Enis Baris.
Okay. So I guess after this presentation, the first question you will ask, why is it me who will be making a presentation on avian influenza, I guess? And I think you wouldn't be that wrong, because when I was asked by Niels and colleagues to make a plenary presentation on avian influenza about 6 months ago, I was quite excited about that, because I was in the thick of preparing a number of avian influenza preparedness projects in four countries at the same time, so traveling a lot in the Caucasus region in Turkey, and being quite frustrated with basically the lack of very immediate and very effective international response, including my own agency, to be able to go to these countries, give them the most up-to-date, scientifically valid and rigorous advice, and work with them to solve the problem at the spot. So I was very much concerned with the readiness of the healthcare systems. On the other hand, if you go 1 year before, even though, as Asma said, I'm a medical doctor and epidemiologist, I knew next to nothing about avian influenza in general. And here I am a year later making a plenary presentation on avian flu. So let's see how it goes. I'll be talking very briefly about the virus, the influenza epidemiology, the basic roots of transmission, clinical features and history, as well as the current situation. But I think the bulk of my presentation will be on system response, how the systems have responded, what is the potential for a pandemic worldwide, what will be the socioeconomic impacts, and what are the priorities in preparing for a potential pandemic, and how we can assess the degree of readiness and preparedness of different countries. And I will conclude with some general remarks. Let's first review very briefly the virus, which is called H5N1. This is a virus which is found generally in wild aquatic ducks and geese. It is these animals, these wild animals, are vector to the virus itself, but they don't necessarily get sick with the virus. The virus, when it is transmitted from these ducks and geese to other animals like more territory geese, as we say, not wild ones, and turkeys and quails, they acquire a certain degree of pathogenicity. And thereafter, when they go to the poultry, the fowl, domesticated animals, especially H5 and H7, they become highly pathogenic. So we always make a distinction between what is low pathogenicity, basically in geese and turkeys, etc., and high pathogenicity, which basically means that the animals will die in about 24 to 48 hours after having acquired the virus. We often talk about H5, H7, H9. You know that these are proteins on the surface of the virus. H stands for hemagglutinin, N for neuraminidase. These are the two proteins. Basically, there are 16 H and 9 N. So there is a combination of, I think, 144 different subtypes of the same virus. And their pathogenicity changes, of course, depending upon the H and N configuration, but also through a lot of mutation. Now, mostly these viruses are transmitted from one animal to another animal through feces, but also through the use of contaminating the same kind of water or food. There is also some report in the literature that the transmission can occur in other animals, especially in mammals like cats and pigs and even horses. The transmission to human, and that's a very important point, is not necessarily very clear. There is in the literature records of transmission from human to human, but that is really that needs to be confirmed. I think we have to be very careful here, because if you look at the pandemic classification in the world, we are in stage 3, which means that usually there is no real proven human-to-human transmission. There may be some sporadic cases which really needs to be confirmed. And actually, a virus like this, for it to be transmitted easily to human, that, according to the literature, that requires about 10 mutations. But sometimes what happens is that an avian influenza virus basically reassorts its genetic material with a human influenza virus, and then all of a sudden it can become very pathogenic in humans. This particular virus, H5N1, replicates more easily in lower respiratory system than rather upper respiratory system. And this is one of the reasons given in the literature for its low degree of transmission to humans and between humans. It attacks the immune system. It's basically an immunopathologic disease in the lungs, and it becomes highly fatal. The fatality rate, depending upon the countries, is about 60% in general. Since it's an RNA virus, its genetic material is very unstable. That means that it really mutates very rapidly. And as it mutates, obviously, not only its pathogenicity changes, but also it may acquire resistance to different drugs, antiviral drugs. Amantadine is an example. It has been shown already that there is some resistance, but possibly to oseltamivir, which is the Tamiflu, as you know, the brand name. If you look at this epidemiology, basically, avian influenza virus is very widespread in nature. It has been isolated from more than 90 species. It occurs around the year in most tropical countries, often in winter in moderate climates. And if you go to southern China, I think that you'll be able to harbor most kinds of strains there. As I said, the virus changes its genetic makeup. And basically, in the literature, we make a distinction between antigenic shift and antigenic drift. Antigenic drift is something that happens rather slowly but regularly, and the virus changes its genetic makeup. It may also become more pathogenic and less pathogenic, but the most important and most concerning one is what we call the antigenic shift, which is basically reassortment of the avian virus with a human virus. Then all of a sudden it becomes highly pathogenic to humans, and there is no immunity for human beings. Then it causes epidemics, as I will give you examples in a few minutes. every year we have more or less 700 million to 1.2 billion episodes of influenza. Obviously, these are regular influenza A type influenza in humans. And every year, we lose more or less 300,000 people to influenza. But if you look at the surveillance systems across the world, the estimated number of samples collected around the world is about 158,000. So we are talking about 1.2 billion people, and it's a note that I will get back to later, getting influenza a year and collecting sample on 160,000. And many people think that influenza surveillance is really still in dark ages. We don't know what's going on out there. We are not able to track all the mutations, pathogenicity. Lots of people may be acquiring it. Some people may be dying it. And we don't really know how big is the problem. And that is something I think we have to keep in mind. As far as the avian flu is concerned, the H5N1 type, there have been epidemics in Vietnam, in Thailand, although the first cases were reported in Hong Kong in 1997. And so far, as of October 2006, only 256 reported cases by WHO in 10 different countries. I think this is how we should be seeing the whole transmission. Basically, you have the wild birds, in which they are vectors and they don't get sick. Then there is the terrestrial fowl, the chicken, hens, etc., and then the humans. And the two key points here is when these three groups basically interact and be in touch with each other. When the wild birds and terrestrial fowl, obviously wild birds with the virus, they are in touch with the terrestrial fowl, then we have epizootics. And since 1959, we had 24 highly pathogenic avian influenza epizootics in chicken and hens, in domesticated animals, basically. And then, since again 1959, then there was only one case, we had a number of cases, not really pandemics. I should stress this point. We are not talking about human influenza pandemics. We are talking about avian influenza here. But we have been cases since 1959. So I think these two points, we will get back to that, are very important, the intersection between the wild bird, the terrestrial fowl, and the humans. And if you continue with the routes of transmission, basically, especially at the very beginning, last year in November, December, when we talked about that, you're thinking of migratory birds and their flyways and how they will basically take off from a lake in China and through the Siberia will fly through Europe to Middle East and to Africa and to some of the European countries. That is obviously true. But we should not be thinking that the only way that the virus is transmitted is through birds, migratory birds, to terrestrial fowl. There is also other ways, and most of them are human-made. One is, in the literature again, what is discussed is Trans-Siberian Express. Basically, there is this train which leaves China, crosses the Siberia all the way to Moscow. And along the route, there is a lot of human and animal interaction, people basically buying eggs and chickens, and the birds are there. And people are now thinking that this may have played also a role in the transmission of the virus in its migration from Asia to Europe. But often, the transmission is fecal-oral route, as I said, through contaminated fishes and water, etc. But for humans to acquire it, it requires very close animal-human contact. And I put a picture here for you to see that in Indonesia, these kinds of practices may be common and therefore may result in human infection. It's basically a woman kissing her chicken. Let's see what we call the influenza-like illness, because in most cases, as you know, we are not in a position to diagnose right away whether it is usual human influenza or avian influenza. First, obviously, there is a syndrome we call influenza-like illness, which has an incubation period of 1 to 14 days, but usually it is 3 to 5 days. It is usually like the severe human flu, the same symptoms, more or less high fever, cough, shortness of breath, etc. There may be some radiological evidence of pneumonia, some other symptoms and signs like diarrhea, etc. But often the death comes from complications of acute respiratory distress syndrome and multi-organ failure, basically causing the respiratory system to collapse. But most people who are infected, they start shedding viruses around even the day before the symptoms become visible. And I think that is important to keep in mind because it has implications for therapy eventually. And they stop basically transmitting the virus in the air about 5 days. There are three different types of case definition. Obviously, ILI, influenza-like illness, I just mentioned. Then how we can say that it may be due to avian influenza, then we have to look for history of close contact with other humans or animals with proven H5N1 infection, or whether these are simply health professionals who are using samples contaminated with H5N1. The probable definition is obviously all of the above, but also there may be some signs of pneumonia and other symptoms due to pneumonia, but also positive lab confirmation, which basically comes from samples that you collect from the throat or from trachea of the people who have the suspected who are suspected of having influenza. The confirmation is made by isolating of the H5N1 virus and also a PCR test, a positive identification of H5 protein, and eventually you can look at the serum for antibodies as well. So this is important to think of a case definition in three steps. You may suspect of cases. You may think that they are probable, but confirmation obviously is through isolation of the virus itself or its genetic material through different tests. So history itself will not necessarily confirm that these are avian flu cases. So if you look at the history of the influenza A pandemics in the 20th century, as you, all of you, I'm sure you know, that the first pandemic was in 1918 called the Spanish flu, apparently costed 40 to 50 million lives. It was during the First World War, so the numbers obviously it's difficult to determine with a certain degree of exactitude. But avian flu in 1957 is believed to have caused 1 to 4 million lives. And then there was another one in Hong Kong, more or less the 1 to 4 million lives in 1968. And the H5N1 also basically began in 1997 with a cluster of cases in Hong Kong. So if you look at the timeline, basically from 1918 to 2005, you see that there have been a number of cases in animals over the course of the year. The first really human cases due to avian influenza began in 1997, as I said, in Hong Kong. Then we had some cases in 1999, 2003, Vietnam and Thailand, et cetera, and 2005 in about 10 countries. This is a slide which very nicely summarizes the cases in humans and in animals, a different kind of animals, how it began in China and then in Hong Kong, then it spread to Thailand and Vietnam, and eventually to other countries. So as you see, for the moment, we have had human cases in 10 countries, Azerbaijan, Cambodia, China, Djibouti, Egypt, Iraq, Thailand, Turkey, Vietnam, and Indonesia. But we had avian influenza, obviously, in animals in many, many more countries, including a lot of European countries as well, except North America, I should say. So this map summarizes the human cases. As you see, we have mostly East Asian countries, China, Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, and Indonesia. Then we had a few cases in Azerbaijan, Turkey, Iraq, Egypt, and Djibouti. And this map summarizes both the countries with poultry and wild birds killed with HIV, H5N1, I'm sorry, and also the countries where we had also the human cases. I think what is important here is that you see that the avian virus is very, very widespread across the Asian continent, European continent, and also the African continent. For the moment, being the only continent that is spared is the Americas. This is the number of cases as of October 16 reported to WHO. As you will see, there are 10 countries for a total of 256 cases, and 151 deaths so far. As you see, the case fatality rate is quite high, about 60%, although in some countries it's a bit different, and some people try to explain it by saying that in those countries the cases were detected early on and they were put on antiviral treatment, therefore the case fatality was lower, but the numbers are too small to make it a really strong assertion. Let's look at the system response now. The first thing, obviously, is the surveillance, and in my opinion, is the weakest link. First of all, the veterinary surveillance, especially in developing worlds, either whether it is middle income or low income, is extremely weak. It is very, very difficult to find out unless there is a mass number of deaths in chicken and then you get samples. But also often there is a problem with diagnosis. For example, we know that in India and Nigeria, when they had avian flu in chicken, the first diagnosis was Newcastle disease. Newcastle disease is a very common viral infection in chicken, which also has high mortality. But the diagnosis is often the problem on the veterinary side. On the human side, it is also a problem. I think if you look at the recent history of human disease, there have been 117 emerging new human diseases, and more than 50 of them actually jumped from animals. And we are not really globally, and frankly speaking, in a position to monitor them all. Flu monitoring is also not that developed. I mean, except in USA, where there's a real-time disease reporting in about, I believe, 120 cities surveyed by the CDC. In the rest of the world, it is not like that. You often have voluntary physicians who are part of a sentinel site in a country, and then they will report periodically the number of flu cases, or I should say ILI, that they have. But often these are based on reports and not necessarily case confirmation with the sampling. As I said, globally there have been only 160,000 samples collected and confirmed by laboratories. So it's a major problem. The other issue with regard to surveillance is the collaboration. In many countries, you have obviously the ministries of health, ministries of environment, ministries of agriculture, ministries of finance, etc. And it is not always easy to bring them all together and work together, have a common surveillance scheme. It doesn't mean that they have to do the surveillance together all the time, but there has to be a certain collaboration. And now in some of the projects I'll talk about later, what we have, we develop what we call the zoonotic disease committees with representatives from different ministries and informing each other regularly. There are also some other means. I will talk about that a bit later. But this is something that is lacking in most countries vis-a-vis surveillance, but also vis-a-vis response that I will again talk later. Another issue is the need for full international collaboration between WHO, OIE and FAO. Now, as you know, WHO is in charge of global public health. FAO is mostly related to food hygiene and safety. OIE is mostly related to what is called trade of animal and animal products. OIE is basically based in Paris, FAO is in Rome, WHO is in Geneva. And until recently, and I think that that's one of the maybe positive things that came out from this recent global experience with avian flu, that they were pretty much working in parallel. Now I think that there has been this initiative to put them all together, to work together, to put their efforts together for global surveillance, both on the veterinary side and also on the human side. Again, so the key things, I'm coming back to this slide because I think it is important to show that we have to have a very well-developed veterinary surveillance system and we have to have a very well-developed epidemiological surveillance system. Now, I think globally it will be unrealistic to expect that we will have a very effective veterinary surveillance system in place in most countries. What will then be important, especially for us public health workers, we need to make sure that we will have the epidemiologic surveillance in place so that we can identify that index case very, very quickly. And I'll give you some examples of failing to do so. As for case detection and outbreak investigation, obviously we need more epidemiologists, and I don't think that we have enough. And I'm not talking about epidemiologists in the general sense of the world. Obviously, there are epidemiologists, and the numbers will vary from one country to another. But field epidemiologists who can go and very quickly mount a survey for case detection, identifying the index case and the second cases, etc., and then come up with a report on which one can act. That is lacking, and that's lacking even in European countries. I will refer to that a bit later. We need national coordination, not only, as I said, between the government agencies, but also between villages, health workers, and scientists. And that also means that there has to be a very good communication, open, transparent, impartial communication between all these groups. And then real-time intersectoral action to be able to go to the field and basically extinguish the fire on the spot. But all this will require better laboratory capacity as well, as you know. Confirmation of cases is very important. I'll give you an example from my own experience recently from two countries. For example, in Turkey, when they first detected the case in eastern part of Turkey, close to the Iranian border, the sample was taken and analyzed by the reference laboratory in Ankara in about 20 hours. It took less than 24 hours for the first sample to be taken from the patient to go to Ankara to the laboratory. Now, this is quite good. I would say it's really very good, especially given the fact that there is about 1,000 kilometers between the city where the sample was taken and the reference laboratory where it is located. Compare this with what happened in Azerbaijan when there was first sample taken and the sample was not being transported to capital Baku, and there was no laboratory facility that could make a quick test and confirmation. They had to wait for the sample to be taken out of the country to another laboratory, reference laboratory, and there was not a container which will be acceptable to international carriers like Lufthansa to take the sample and to carry it to another country. Therefore, it took about 2 weeks, if I remember correctly, for some bilateral agencies to bring a PCR equipment from another country to Azerbaijan to collect, to analyze the samples, and then they had to procure a new container which will be acceptable to the international carriers to be taken to take the sample to London, to the reference laboratory, and to Egypt eventually. So this is obviously very, very important, and I just gave you two examples from two different countries. I'm sure most of the countries will be somewhere in between, but in a case like that, it is extremely important to be able to confirm the cases right away. The treatment is also important. Why? Obviously, the literature says that if you act only, if you put people on antivirals during the first 2 days or so when they are mildly symptomatic, that may reduce hospitalization and eventually death. I think is some report that up to 60% of the hospitalization may be reduced with early treatment and maybe 30 to 40% of deaths. But these are some reports based on limited number of studies as well. Case management is extremely important because imagine in a situation like that when people don't know what they are really handling, how to transport these patients, whether they are contagious, how to give protective gear to people, whether the hospitals have ventilators, whether you can put them in ICUs, whether you can check the blood gases, etc., and how to protect the personnel. These are all the very important aspects of case management, and I can assure you, based on my experience of visiting several countries and hospitals and ICUs and looking at the ventilators, outdated equipment, protective equipment, etc., that it's not obvious that the countries are ready for this. Counseling as well is very important because there is always a media hype, people talking about a new pandemic is at the door, and you have to obviously talk with the parents, the villagers, the larger community, and indeed with the whole nation. Antivirals, as I said, they may help contain outbreak and delay the pandemic if administered early. they should not be used for general prophylactic reasons. First of all, I mean, you can simply induce resistance, obviously, and it may not be cost effective. And in most cases, the countries do not have enough in stocks to be able to give it to the general population. So it has to be localized and targeted use. The production of oseltamivir has increased from 190 million doses. It will increase to 400 million. And I believe WHO also received about 8 million or so from Roche, the company, freely for use in emergency conditions. But one has to keep in mind the potential for resistance. And also, there is a need for injectable antivirals so that they can be used directly and more effectively. It is estimated that in most countries, if you have enough in stock to cover 20-25% of the population, usually it is said that in an influenza pandemic situation, 30% of the population will get infected. So that means that if you have stocks for 20-25% of the population, like 80-90% of the population will maybe get infected, then this may help contain the pandemic. But obviously, first use, especially if the stocks are not there, should be reserved for persons at high risk. And in terms of stocks, again, based on my experience in many countries, there are not enough stocks. Obviously, it is a very, very contentious area because it costs about, if I remember correctly, about 10 euro a dose. Then if you make such a huge investment to put 1 million doses, for example, in stock, and if it doesn't happen, what you do with that? So obviously there is a cost to be for readiness, but this has to be evaluated again very carefully. In terms of the containment of pandemic, I maintain that the most important thing is hand washing. It is as simple as that, the most important public health message. But if people keep on washing their hands, probably there will be less infection. Vaccinating is important. We don't have vaccines. I will talk about that in a minute. Vaccination against influenza always comes a few steps behind the mutation. As you know, for example, there is usually a human influenza virus which comes to the market in the fall, but often is based on the viruses isolated the year before. So this is something that we have to keep in mind, but obviously vaccination, if we can have efficacious vaccines, can be a very effective tool to use. Mass communication is extremely important. Again, if I can give you an example, I think in Turkey they did it quite well. They set up a crisis group in the Ministry of Health and started passing messages. And I was looking at the messages at that time, and the messages were very consistent. And they were very consistent within the nation and also internationally. So that means that because usually when you don't have a good mass communication strategy, what happens? Some person says that we have 20 more cases, 5 people died. The international media says something, the other one says, and there is no more trust into the system. So mass communication is extremely important to basically alleviate the fear, telling people what's happening, whether they can eat eggs, whether they can eat chicken, whether they have to cook chicken at a certain temperature, etc., etc., and also how they have to behave. In many developing countries, as you know, people sell chicken on the street. Live chicken can be bought and slaughtered right on the spot. Actually, it will be, I would really highly recommend for you to look at some of the pictures coming from East Asia to see the ecology in which chicken and chickens and humans live together. With all this interaction, there is so many public health messages to pass. Social distancing can be an effective measure. School closure, I'm sorry for the typing error there, it should be school. School closure can be effective. Cancellation of mass events and concerts and mass gathering, football games, etc. is important. Domestic travel should be discouraged. But on the other hand, we don't really have any evidence that isolation and quarantine can be effective. Border closing can be effective. As you know, viruses pass from one country to another very easily. Let me give you another example. I was once going by land, again, during the preparation of these avian flu projects from Armenia to Georgia, and we were stopped at the border, and we saw this man with some kind of a device in his bag and spraying all the cars. He had a protective gear which was half open, and he was smoking and also spraying the thing on the tires of our car. And when I asked him what he was doing, he said that this will kill all the viruses. So I think, you know, that is a border control measure of very dubious effectiveness, I would say. So I think that, I mean, I'm not saying that it should not be done. If it is done effectively, it may help. But at the end of the day, the borders are porous, as you know. For many birds and viruses, there are no passport control. So, vaccine development. Several trials are ongoing. It takes about 9 months from development to availability. Obviously, you have to develop, you have to test for safety, efficacy, effectiveness, and then they have to be available worldwide. But world capacity for the moment being is estimated to be around 300 million doses a year. And also the virus is mutating rapidly. So a vaccine that may be developed now, which may be effective, may not be effective in 2-3 months time. And according to the first results of vaccine studies, that it may require two different doses, which may be given even with 3 weeks apart. Obviously, it will have logistic problems. Imagine of having two doses of vaccine, inviting people to come back in 21 days. The day later on is not necessarily the most effective way to secure compliance. Many vaccines which are being developed, they have also adjuvants which apparently improve their immunogenicity. And maybe through the use of different adjuvants that one may reduce the number of doses to one, which may obviously increase compliance eventually. But adjuvants have also the added benefit of given some cross-protection between different strains of the virus. But in most, for most influenza vaccines, the immunity usually lasts about 2 years. So that is also something we have to keep in mind. And most of the vaccines are still developed using eggs as a medium. Now, the companies, obviously, they have good reason to do so because that is a method which has been proven. Therefore, they don't have to go back to FDA or other agencies to get the, the new method cleared again. So it will reduce the time from first testing to put it on the market, but also it still takes 9 months. I think that we need new methods, cell culture-based methods, to develop vaccines more quickly. But another issue is the protection from litigation. As you may know, during the swine flu epidemic in 1976 in the U.S., there have been a number of deaths after the administration of vaccines, and this is an area where the state can jump in and say, okay, I'll protect those who will develop vaccines against litigation, which may give more incentive to vaccine producers. Let's talk a bit of the potential for pandemic. What is a pandemic? I think it's a word that is used quite indiscriminately, in my opinion. Basically, we make a distinction between epidemic, pandemic, and endemic, as you know. And pandemic is, unlike the epidemic, is unlimited in place, limited in time. An epidemic is usually is limited in place and limited in time. So that means that it may last 6 months, 3 months, 1 year, et cetera, but it will be all around the world in many countries at the same time. According to one survey in the U.S., 56% of the doctors think that there will be a pandemic in the next 4 years of avian influenza type, obviously. The United Nations estimates that there may be between 5 to 150 million deaths worldwide. Obviously, this is a very wide range. And the main reason for that, because we don't have good mathematical modeling to come up with more rigorous, more estimates, and with more narrow confidence bounds. What are the prerequisites for a pandemic? Obviously, it has to be a new novel virus against which there is no human immunity. It has to replicate very fast, and it has to cause diseases, obviously, but also it has to be very efficient human-to-human. There has to be very efficient human-to-human transmission. Does H5N1 have that? No, not for the moment being, but again, it may acquire, especially through reassortment with a common human influenza virus, which affects human beings. That is the way for reassortment. In case of a pandemic, what is the likely scenario? First of all, I think most of the people will require some kind of medical care. If you look at the, again, some studies coming from the U.S., it is estimated that there may be an increase of up to 50-60% in outpatient visits. Imagine the workload of doctors doubling in a case like that. Most countries obviously will not have enough staff, hospital beds, facilities and equipment necessary to cope with such a large number of pupils. If there is no early antiviral treatment, many of them may require hospitalization as well, and it can totally overwhelm the facilities. Obviously, vaccines are the best method for the moment being, but as I said, given the world production capacity, we may not have enough to go around. And obviously, there will be a huge market, there will be all kinds of market distortion. Some countries would like to stockpile, et cetera, et cetera. I don't even want to get into that, the chaos that may ensue from limited supply in case of a very increased demand. So what is important is in situations like that, how we can make sure that the person hygiene can be improved, whether we will make some reasonable common sense quarantine and travel restrictions. These are the kind of things that we may control a bit with mass communication, and then maybe we can reduce, contain, and delay the pandemic. But obviously, at the end of the day, the health systems will be very severely tested in terms of their preparedness. On the social economic impact side, according to my own institution, that a severe pandemic could cost to the global economy about 3.1% of the world GDP, which is a very huge number, obviously. It will be due to cost of increased illness, and that among humans and animals, but also cost of all kinds of preventive strategies, but also because people will not report to work, they will, you know, there will be all kinds of disruption in production processes. So there is direct cost related to healthcare, obviously, but also indirect cost due to loss of productivity. But there will also be economic consequences and trade implications. I'm not going to go into the detail of this, but at the end of the day, mostly small-scale farmers, the poorest part of the population, will suffer the most. Some numbers, some estimated, some coming from the countries. For example, the poultry sector accounts for about up to 2% of GDP in East Asia. And in case of a single out large break in Southeast Asia, the GDP growth can be curtailed by 1.5% reduction in the GDP growth overall. So one estimate from Vietnam that it cost them $50 million due to 15% reduction in poultry sector. The same estimate for Indonesia is about tenfold, $500 million. In Romania, for example, the sales fell by 80% after the first avian flu cases in birth, sale of obviously chicken, eggs, and etc. In Turkey, there was a reduction of 30%. And actually, one estimate we had in Turkey was about that the sector was losing, it's a sector of about $3 billion, was losing $1 million a day. So all of a sudden, the market capitalization of the sector, imagine going down 30-40% in the wake of the crisis like that in a matter of a couple of days. But often what happens also, people, especially the small farmers, they lose their livelihood. They are forced to give away their chicken for culling. And at the end, this is often staple food, the only source of protein for them, and they lose that as well. So there are implications, economic, socioeconomic implications at the, at the household level, but all the way up to the nation, obviously. So what are the key challenges? Lack of effective vaccine is a major challenge. The systems, the healthcare system, don't have the surge capacity to all of a sudden expand their activities. They don't even actually, in most countries, have the capacity to accommodate in even the modest pandemics. There is obviously the high risk of healthcare workers being affected during a pandemic like that. But what is a bit longer-term concern and a challenge is that the world is really, with the increase in population, increase in mortality, and increase in the agribusiness, which has becoming more and more effective and efficient. More land, pieces of land claimed by human beings for all kinds of production activities, whether it's poultry, husbandry, etc. That makes the ecology all the tighter and bring people together. Again, if I'm referring to the three intersecting circles. So, zoonotic diseases, including the avian influenza, will be a major challenge for us to come. I know that it's almost getting, let me go through a few slides here. In terms of the preparedness, obviously WHO asked all countries to prepare a plan. About 40 countries have done so. But if you look at these plans, they are very good on paper. I don't want to generalize. I didn't see all the papers, obviously. But I saw a few of them. They look on paper good. But if you ask them whether they have the resources to implement those plans, whether they have had any dry run based on those plans, there are very, very few countries that have done so. And if you ask them whether they have the material in stock, like antivirals, etc., it is also a case that the stockpiles are nowhere near what the need would be. So there is this issue of working on the national plans and putting the stocks there, training the people, even simple things like transportation material, vials to collect samples, etc., so that in the case of a pandemic, quick action can be taken. To date, there are about, as I said, 40 or so countries that have made their plans publicly available. You will look at this list and you will notice that some of the key countries, like, for example, Vietnam and China, they have not made their plans publicly available, at least when this was put. And some of the other countries, especially in Africa, for example, like Egypt, where there could be continue to hear that new cases are happening, they haven't made their plans publicly available as well. If you look at the European example very quickly, for example, in Europe, there is this European program for intervention epidemiology training. And by 2001, they had only 43 epidemiologists in, at that time, 15 European countries trained. And according to one survey, they find a number of critical points that were missing. Failure to identify and report cases across countries and within countries, failure to inform other countries, as I said. They didn't necessarily have the preparedness planning. They didn't have the funding arrangements. They didn't know where the money will come from in case of increased number of cases, samples collecting, etc. The information was not necessarily linked to action. Etc., etc. So I think even in Europe, although this is a bit dated, I just want to highlight the critical points because they are applicable to many other countries. But even as recent as 2001 and 2002 in Europe, there weren't enough epidemiologists and there were major failures in the degree of preparedness. This is a more recent survey coming from the WHO Europe unit. And if you look at this, they basically send out questionnaires to 56 countries of the WHO European region. 89% of them had some kind of a plan. Some kind of a body, but in terms of plans, only 55% of them. Again, I will not go into details. The degree of readiness and preparedness, depending upon the components of the plan, varied quite a lot. For example, has the national plan been tested through an exercise? Only 13% of the countries had some kind of a mock or simulation exercise. Here, different components of the national influenza program, again, based on this European survey. If you look at, for example, whether the governments, and this is Europe, okay, one of the most developed part of the world, together with North America. If you look at it, whether the government maintain a stock of antiviral drugs, only 43% of the countries said yes, they do. So, if you go far east to Vietnam, for example, the situation is not very, encouraging. First of all, if you look at the poultry production, most of the poultry production is backyard farming, maybe 80-90%. It is all the more difficult to intervene at that level. So humans and the poultry live all together. It's just one same ecology. You go to the market, you go to the street, you can buy a live chicken, you can have it slaughtered on the spot. If you look at the country's healthcare system, in terms of antiviral drugs, lack lack of stockpile equipment, laboratory capacity, hospital facilities, etc. So it requires a lot of preparedness for a country like Vietnam, which may not have the resources. Therefore, the need for international cooperation, obviously. Laboratory isolation is extremely important as a challenge for non-EU countries because laboratory facilities are often not there, especially the hierarchy in laboratory, having reference laboratories, for example, before the sample could be taken out of the country to an international reference center. I will very briefly talk about some of the examples from my own personal involvement in four countries, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, and Turkey. And this is the European region in terms of the distribution of the avian flu in birds and in the poultry sector. As you see, a lot of countries and a lot of zones in the same country have been affected. If you look at the Caucasus region, so Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia, I think the number of things. One is the laboratory system is not in place, although there is a bit variation. For example, in Georgia, they have a better laboratory because they happen to have received assistance from the U.S. government recently to build a high-tech laboratory, but in others, they don't have necessarily the laboratory capacity. Information system for mass communication, but also training of the healthcare workers were not necessarily there. The sanitary control of markets, especially, was not necessarily there. We prepared projects in each one of those countries with an animal health component, human health component, and public awareness component so that we can beef up the laboratories first and create in some reference hospitals the basics to treat severe cases and transport the cases there and also for public awareness. In Turkey, the situation was a bit different. It's, after all, middle-income and quickly becoming a high middle-income country. The preparedness was much more advanced. There was good cooperation also between the Minister of Agriculture and the Minister of Health. As I said, the cases were detected rather quickly. The overall case fatality was a bit lower because of probably early early action, but even there, there is a need to have more public health laboratories with higher biosafety levels, not only one in Ankara and Istanbul, but also in other places as well. Am I running late? 2 minutes, okay, I'm finishing. These are the closing remarks. I think the key thing is the permanent state of vigilance. If you think about it, there are 16 billion chicken and 1 billion ducks in the world. The land use is ever increasing. Cattle and poultry production is ever expanding, and there is a high mobility of population masses within the countries and across borders. And we have several strains of the virus quickly mutating and reassorting. When you have that kind of a scenario, obviously that means that we have to be highly vigilant. The second thing is that we have to understand that we cannot eradicate this. It will be there. As long as you have wild birds, the virus will be there, and there will be different types of virus. The problem itself cannot be solvable, but it may be managed. First, we need a much better surveillance of the flu. That is important, and constant subtyping and following very closely all the mutations in different subtypes. We have to have a better surveillance of on the veterinary side. Vaccinating poultry has been advanced as one measure. Some countries like China and Vietnam tried, but it's a very tricky thing. If you are highly effective and you can vaccinate all the poultry, it may help. It may, but if you don't, then the chicken will not die right away, that they will be carriers, and the risk of infection for humans will be higher, and also there may be all kinds of resistance to the vaccines that you may be developing for humans. That is a very tricky area that if it can be done effectively, it may be a measure, but otherwise it is not necessarily highly recommended. Culling infectious flocks is a measure. Apparently 200 million chicken have already been culled in the world. But again, it is not necessarily totally effective, especially in countries where there is a lot of backyard farming. If you look at Turkey, 95% of the chicken is in the poultry industry. So it's better circumscribed and you can control it. Only 5% is backyard farming in terms of numbers. But if you go to other countries, 80% is backyard. How you are going to go and ask every villager to be compliant, give their chicken so you can cull, especially if there's no compensation schemes like many countries don't have. So, but that is something that needs to be managed. Obviously, vaccine production is extremely important. And as you know, this will go with us saying a bit of a platitude, but intersectoral collaboration and international cooperation are, especially in cases like this, of global nature, will be all the more important. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much. I think you should stay there. Yes, I think there will be a few questions. We have time for a few questions. Ken?
Ines, thank you. For a person who started out this presentation saying you didn't know anything about avian influenza, I hereby declare you a subject matter expert. I appreciate it. A couple of questions. Has the global community considered a very epidemiologically based approach? I'm disturbed about what you presented. The places at highest risk are the ones most poorly prepared for the immediate response. How can we not come together as a global community and help these places be prepared, as opposed to having me be prepared in the West, waiting for the Far East to go up in flames? So there's that question. You know, has that approach been considered? And of course, I can't help but ask you, how do we, as a global community, leverage the preparedness infrastructure for these urgent threats to address the urgent realities, such as tuberculosis, while we wait for the bad things to happen?
I think that there has been relatively quick, I would say, response from the global community. I mean, I know that WHO has made major efforts in putting teams together, epidemiologists, and dispatching them to countries. And I think that the efforts were really there, although I personally think that simply there are not enough experts around to go from one country to another. Most of these people work very long hours, stretch traveling from one country to another. The same applied to FAO, based on my own experience in a number of countries, and to the World Bank as well. I mean, yes, I'm an epidemiologist, medical doctor, but when I started this, as I said, I didn't know much about avian flu. All of a sudden, I had to immerse myself in the literature while traveling at the same time, trying to build programs for different countries. And actually, I raised this with my colleagues at the IUATLD, and how come that we don't have a SWAT team in the IUATLD that we can dispatch quickly, easily to from one country to another to help them? But multidisciplinary teams, not only epidemiologists, but virologists, etc. I think this has been an eye-opener and wake-up call for the global community. And we are extremely lucky that this virus doesn't transmit so easily from animals to human and from human to human. If it did, we would have had, I don't know how many millions of cases. So this is important. As international finance organizations, if I may go to World Bank and others, I think we moved rather quickly in putting together a global facility where we, in the World Bank first, made about, if I remember, $400 million available to countries who will seek funding from the World Bank right away. And most of those funds were concessionary funds, so without carrying any interest. But also there have been meetings like the one in Beijing where donor community came together, EU, DFID, etc., and pledging money. But the problem often is
how to spend this money, how to disperse it right away. It's not necessarily the amount of money, because you still have to have a project, you still have to have a program, you have to identify your needs, how many doses of Tamiflu you are going to buy, how many ventilators you will buy, and that always takes a bit of time. So preparing global response with international agencies in a very brief period of time is not necessarily that quick. I mean, even in Azerbaijan, Georgia, Armenia, and Turkey, where we prepared project, it took us about 3 to 4 months to take this project, prepare, identify the project, and take it to the World Bank board. And they were done really very, very fast. I mean, compared with the average duration of a project preparation, they were done in 20% of the time that it will usually take. So to me, that is like a wake-up call. I think we learned from this experience. We have to get our act together. WHO, OIE, and FAO should get together for surveillance, especially. And all other agencies also have to put their efforts together to be able to dispatch multidisciplinary teams, as I said, as soon as on the spot.
Yeah. And Ken's question about TB and waiting for disasters to happen.
Could you expand on it a bit?
Pardon me. But the whole point is that we're building this whole new infrastructure for the urgent threat, and I think it is very appropriate. I mean, the only thing, as I heard Bruce Gellin say, that's worse than having to prepare for pandemic flu is explaining why you were not prepared having forecasted it. So I very much accept that at face value. But now, there are so many other unmet needs, and yet we have all these resources that are going to building this infrastructure, and I think we're challenged to determine how can we leverage that so that while we wait for the pandemic influenza to occur, we deploy the outreach workers that are needed for case identification, case containment, for TB, just to name one of multiple unmet health needs.
Okay, excellent question. I think I would fully agree with you. Actually, when we started putting these projects together, we really had to make sure to the countries that this is not just for avian flu. This is you have to have a surveillance system, period, not surveillance system for avian flu. And I think the people that we are trying to train through this and buying the laboratory equipment, et cetera, the emphasis has always been for the overall health system development. I think that is something we have to, obviously, there may be some particular areas where it has to be avian flu and nothing else. If you need a viral, special equipment like PCR or whatever. But the emphasis is really building the surveillance system globally, because that is lacking. I mean, a few years ago it was SARS, now it is avian flu, and who knows what's going to happen in 2-3 years' time. And my own personal view is that we will keep on having these kinds of threats and challenges, respiratory to respiratory type, and therefore, I think, one of the things that I have been advocating in the Union is we have to put more and more emphasis on lung health in general, because most of the diseases of this nature will have lung health implications. Thank you.
Thank you. Two more questions, you, and then we'll...
Okay. Thank you. That is a comment rather than a question to save time. And thank you very much to raise the importance of the avian influenza. And no doubt we have lots to do. I just want to illustrate a case that how the TB people can contribute for the avian influenza. For example, you have illustrated the efforts needed at international level, national level, but there is also the effort for the district level. For example, like how the local doctor is going to detect the patients with influenza-like units from thousands of them who have backyard chickens in the developing countries. And secondly, for the public health actions, for example, like the investigation and the contact tracing and the disinfection, etc. So we, as Nuffield in the University of Leeds, we have collaborated with WHO, try to produce operational death guide, or operational guideline for the local public health doctors and doctors to do the jobs on the daily cases, so that there's a way that the TB people can contribute to this emerging pandemic, if possible. Thank you.
to report?
That's excellent, obviously. I think, yes, obviously, when you make a presentation like that, you put the emphasis national and international, but most of the work, outbreak investigation, et cetera, happens at the local level. Again, if I can give you an example from Turkey where I followed up a bit, you know, if it weren't for the local doctor who suspected it's maybe avian flu, who sent the patient to a university facility where they have ventilators, et cetera, although many of the patients died, but maybe this would not have been detected so quickly. So everything at the end is local. I fully agree with you.
One more question.
Paul Sommerfeld, International Society for Influenza and Other Respiratory Virus Diseases. Just want to say, first of all, thank you to you for that very fine summary of the flu situation, and thank you also to the Union for including this session on flu within the Congress. But just I wanted to make a mention of a new initiative trying to assist in one small way with improved scientific responses to the potential flu pandemic. There has not previously been an international society focused specifically on flu and respiratory disease, respiratory virus disease. And a year ago, what we're now calling ICERV was launched. And with Blackwell's, we'll be launching in January a new journal specifically on influenza, scientific journal on influenza and respiratory virus disease. And there are leaflets. I'm afraid this is a bit of a marketing ploy, but there are leaflets about the association and the new journal on the front of the podium at the front there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. You want to respond? Then I just want to thank everyone for attending the session, and I want to thank Dr. Boris very much for a very enlightening talk, and now at least I know a little bit about it. Thank you.